Hello, and welcome to episode 229 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Rick and I are both on vacation this week, so we've looked through our archives and picked four of our favorite ethical dilemmas from 2025. We hope you enjoy listening to them, and we'll be back next week with a brand new episode. We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma, and Rick, I hear that you have a question for me.
So, Scott, there was a story recently by Stephanie Murray in The Atlantic that described an incident during a train ride. She said that her four-year-old daughter she was traveling in a foreign country, and they were on a train. And her four-year-old daughter was sitting on a seat, and she lifted one foot up and placed it on the seat. There was an older woman sitting next to her daughter, and this woman reached her hand out and tapped her foot, indicating that she should put her foot down. Murray went on to discuss how there are different customs in different countries of strangers correcting people's behavior. Because as an American, at first, she was shocked by this. Here's this person I don't even know who's correcting my daughter. But she said her daughter immediately took her foot down, and she was kind of, her daughter was surprised by this, right? It led me to reflect, is there ever a situation where you would feel comfortable or feel appropriate correcting the behavior of a stranger's child?
You gave me this question in advance, and you also, and I did look up this article that Stephanie Murray in The Atlantic wrote just for background, and it was an interesting article, and we'll link to it in the show notes. And I don't know if you remember, but this was actually happened in or around Prague is where this incident happened. And of course, I have remarkably good insight into this, Rick, because just weeks ago, I was on a train in Prague.
Yes.
So this is perfect for me. Although I don't think I was corrected.
Did anybody correct you, tell you to take your feet off the
seat?
Well,
it's funny you, and see, that actually gets to the root of how I'm going to answer this. The way you framed this was, is there ever a situation where you would correct the behavior of another person's child? And how she writes this article is about how, I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but, you know, in some societies, and maybe in America at one time, that there was sort of a communal approach to parenting, and that you had kids that were oftentimes at home less than they are today, and that if you were at the corner store buying candy and gum because you had, you know, 75 cents in your pocket and were acting kind of squirrely, the manager of the dime store would have no hesitation to say, hey, I mean, you know, stop doing that. And that was just sort of how things went at one time, and that probably happens a lot less today. My position on this is that, again, setting aside like infants, right? I mean, if you have a 6-month-old crying next to you, I mean, you can't convince the 6-month-old to stop crying. We know that's the case.
Right.
So
right.
Setting those things aside, but in this case, it was what, a 4-year-old daughter, and the 4-year-old, although was easy for the 4-year-old to pick up the prompt from this woman on the train, and she corrected her behavior quickly. I'm not sure why this is framed up around, would you correct the behavior of other people's children? What I would ask the writer of this piece is, if you think it's okay for a woman to correct her 4-year-old from putting a foot up on a seat, do you think it's also okay for that woman to correct a 44-year-old for doing that? Because in my mind, if you're bothered by a 4-year-old and you did what this woman in the piece did and kind of motioned and the 4-year-old put her foot down, that you should be just as free to correct a 44-year-old or, you know, someone who's significantly older. I just don't see why we should feel more free to correct a child's actions and less free to correct an adult's actions. To me, if you're convinced that you can communicate what you're trying to, the behavior you're trying to change, which in this case she could as a 4-year-old and clearly could for a 44-year-old, you should have the same freedom to do so, and the age really shouldn't matter.
So that's an interesting take on it, because I immediately thought of Robert Putnam's book,
titled Our Kids. Putnam was the Harvard scholar who wrote Bowling Alone,
yep,
about social capital in the United States. And one of his follow-up books was Our Kids, talking about how, like, in America, there used to be this sense of the kids that are living in our community are our kids. And my kids aren't just my kids. They're part of this whole group. And we all have responsibility for raising them. And so that, and I think this Stephanie Murray is taking this woman as kind of,
yeah,
exhibiting this, what we would say, an older attitude towards child raising.
And I think Stephanie said in a positive way. She
in
made herself, yes,
way.
Yes.
Yeah. And what it made me think of immediately was an incident when I was growing up. My friend Steve and I were riding bikes. We were about 10 or 11 years old. We were riding down the sidewalk, and he was Catholic. I wasn't. And the priest was walking down the sidewalk, and the priest says, Steve, you need a haircut. And he just immediately says, yes, Father. And I thought that was so strange. Like, why is this other person beside his parents telling him he needs a haircut? And he was just accepting it as, oh, that's completely natural for this, my priest, to tell me, you know, what I ought to do.
So can I stop you on that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So using that example, I would say, you know, I would assume that the priest would not have said that. I don't know. Maybe he would. I don't know. But
wouldn't have said it to me.
Wouldn't have said it to you, but also wouldn't have sent it to, like, that your Steve, is that your friend's name?
Yeah.
Steve's father. Would he have said that to Steve's father if you were biking / walking down the street past,
nope,
Steve's father? So that seems what's weird to me. And, like, so, but let's say, for example, you're buzzing down the sidewalk and there is an elderly woman walking down the sidewalk. And because you and Steve are going way too fast and reckless on your bike, that this elderly woman almost falls over, right? Well, to me then, if the priest said, hey, guys, you need to slow down. You almost knocked that woman over and she's like 107 years old. That's just bad behavior. I think that's clear, right? And that's more important than a haircut. At the same time, I would say that whether you're, how old were you at the time? 8 or 10 or whatever,
yeah, something like that.
It doesn't matter. If I would say that if I saw that behavior and there was an 8-year-old, I'd say, hey, you need to slow down. You'd almost knock that woman over and she could break a hip and that, like, could be real bad. And I would say the same thing if it were an adult. And I just don't see why we would call out somebody who's 8 years old, but would it call out somebody who's, like, clearly an adult? And the haircut thing to me is personal nonsense. But
whatever. Because I don't think it's calling out. I don't think that's what this woman is doing with the 4-year-old. She isn't, the 4-year-old just doesn't understand yet. There's a proper way of doing things.
Oh, but every 24-year-old does?
Yeah.
No.
They should know. They should know that you don't put your feet up on the
seat. They should know, but I promise you that happens.
Yeah, but with the 24-year-old, they do know and they're doing it anyway.
Sure.
You are calling it out.
Yes.
The 4-year-old doesn't. And so they're just gently reminded, no, this is how we do it. That's why I think it's entirely appropriate for the stranger to do that. It's not a matter of calling out. It's just a matter of saying, no, this is how we do it. And I think it makes raising children easier if there's agreed upon set of norms that the community takes responsibility for helping children to learn.
Just so you go back to my hypothetical, though, of,
yeah,
you and Steve going quickly down a sidewalk and almost pushing an elderly woman off her feet.
Yeah.
We agree that the priest or any adult should say to that 8-year-old, hey, you need to be a lot more careful. And maybe, I think we agree, because that's like a health and safety issue.
Yeah. And it could be an adult.
So you're saying there's no difference there. You would say something to an 8-year-old or a 28-year-old.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's like an important health issue. But obviously putting your feet up on a seat is more like a convention or a social norm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you would not be in favor of this woman on the train in Prague trying to reinforce what she considers to be social norms on adults.
Well, she might want to do that, but what she would be doing is different.
Because?
Because in with the child, it's instruction. With adults, it's something like reprimand.
Yeah, that's true. But I would argue, though, like you said, we'll presume the 4-year-old didn't know she was doing anything wrong. We'll also presume that the 24-year-old should know what he or she is doing is wrong. Isn't that the 24-year-old actually actions are worse because
they are worse?
But we don't say anything.
Yeah, you may or may not. But I think like the 24-year-old putting their feet up on the seat, you'd make a judgment about that that's rude behavior.
Yes.
And you might even say something about it.
Yes. Like,
you shouldn't, that's rude behavior. And they already know it's rude. But the child, you wouldn't say that's rude.
No.
Right? You say, they just haven't learned yet
mm-hmm.
that's considered rude, or it gets the seat dirty. They're because they're children.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah. But see, I would be more forgiving of a child for that very reason, because they probably don't know better. And what I say is thing, maybe I wouldn't, but I would be more likely to say something to an adult for that very reason, because that adult does know better.
Oh, so this is interesting. So you wouldn't feel like it's part of your role to help the mother raise that child appropriately by reminding them, like, no, this is something you shouldn't do. But you would feel more comfortable correcting the adult.
Yes.
Because then you are not helping to raise them. You're just telling them, yeah, don't do that. That's in my presence. It's rude.
Okay, so I'll probably tell a story that makes me look bad. But I have less patience than I should for, and again, I apologize in advance if there's people listening in this profession. I have less patience for semi-truck drivers in the middle of large cities, especially when they decide that they can block traffic because they're big, right? And they can't get into like all the spots they can get into. And like there's a particular place, and this is especially when I'm sometimes out bicycling, well, they'll just sort of park their semi-trucks fully loaded in the middle of a street because they're just sort of waiting for their turn at the loading dock. And that's just how they're going to operate. And my position is, you know, I'm an amateur driver. I mean, I passed a test when I was 16, but like, you know, I'm not a professional driver. But if you're operating those large semis, I mean, you have a higher level of education, you have a higher level of training, and you're a professional driver. So I have more expectations of you as a professional driver than me. So like you should, you know, so I'm much more patient with someone who's like a regular driver like me for doing something silly versus a professional driver. So I may have had a conversation or two with those professional drivers about why they're blocking a street just because it's more convenient for them. And I just, maybe I'm drawing an awkward parallel here, but that's why I have more expectations of like a 24-year-old's behavior than a 4-year-old's behavior, because they're a professional adult. Maybe that's a strange way to phrase it, but they do know right from wrong. And yeah, I guess going back to your kind of the crux of your question is, do we as a society have a responsibility to reinforce those role or those expectations of children who are outside of our direct control? I mean, probably we do. And I generally agreed with the Stephanie Murray's article, I think we are so hesitant to correct the behavior of people who should know better.
Are you saying you're more likely to correct the behavior of something only when you get angry or frustrated with them, but not of a child, because you're not angry with the child, so you're not going to do anything about it. But if an adult does something wrong, you're going to be angry, so you're going to do something about it.
I think in a general sense, that's a correct framing of the situation.
Okay. Yeah.
But is that bad?
No, I think that's understandable, but it's just that I was asking not if you would correct a child's behavior because you were angry with them, just because you think, like, that's not how they should do it.
And I'm sort of reinforcing.
You're going to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it seems to me like you're saying, no, that's none of your, that wouldn't enter into it.
Yeah, I guess because I have so low expectation of children's performance in society. I mean, that might be a lot of it, yeah, right?
That could be it.
And I guess, and to me, the difference is, yeah, 4-year-olds, I mean, like we said at the beginning, a 6-month-old, you can't like have a conversation with, like, maybe you should cry a little less. Does not work. In this case, I think 4 is probably the lowest end of where you could have something like that. And in this case, on the train, it worked. But I would say from 4 to 84, that as you grow, I have higher expectations for you as a person. Like I, Rick Kite, have higher expectations for you as a human being in this world than I would someone who's 30, because you've lived a longer life and you've had more life experiences, you have gained more knowledge. And so like I have higher expectations for you than I do someone who's roughly half your age. And maybe that's wrong, but that's just sort of how I look at life.
I agree with that completely. So it's funny that for you, your willingness to correct somebody's behavior is really correlated with the kind of expectations you have for their behavior in the first
place. Especially if they're like, you know, I've worked in, as I said in the show before, worked in local newspapers for a long time, right? And if you have a high ranking official, well, here, I'll give you a specific example. So this was in the news. It was a small story in the general sense, but, you know, you may or may not have heard about it. But there was a superintendent at a school in eastern Wisconsin who, at the beginning of a school board meeting, kicked a reporter who she did not know out of the meeting because she just felt like what was going to be discussed was really kind of going to be sensitive and she'd rather not have the reporter there. Well, I mean, obviously that goes against I can speak for Wisconsin and probably every other state that you just can't do that. This is an open meeting that goes against all these rules and such. And with this case, if she would have been just like a 3 month in school board member who just didn't quite know the rules and wasn't familiar with this, I mean, you probably should know better, but I mean, I give the person some flack. But this was like a longtime superintendent who had experience in many other districts and had been to more school board meetings than I'm sure anybody else we know definitely should know better. So I guess I use that as an example of how I hold people, what her age doesn't matter, but I hold people who have high levels of expertise when they show poor judgment. And I guess that's, I've really taken this far afield, I realize, from your question, but
yeah, but you're also saying your willingness to correct somebody's behavior is really tied to your judgment of whether they should know better or not.
I would say that's perfectly said.
Okay.
And yeah. I think
the opposite, like my willingness to correct somebody's behavior is more tied to whether they just don't know better and whether they can be reminded like this is how we do it. So that's,
yeah.
I think we just have a difference in how we approach other people's behavior.
Well, as often happens, these small time ethical dilemmas can reveal a lot about how we look at everyday life. We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, here is my very hypothetical question for you. A friend of yours confides in you that he recently won a lottery jackpot of more than $50 million. He says he's only told his wife, along with recently hiring an attorney and a financial advisor. He has two children, ages 10 and 12. He says he's tempted to not tell them until they're much older. He's also worried that if more people know, he'll always be hounded for money. He's curious what you think he should do. What's your advice to him? And I guess I should, let me just add one more thing.
Go ahead.
That your friend has a very middle-class lifestyle. You know, he was doing fine, but obviously would not have been someone who anyone would have considered wealthy before this.
The first bit of advice I would give would not be actual advice. It'd just be some questions, and it'd be asking him what his goals are in life. Like, what does he hope to achieve? And his goals might be changed now that he has all this money. He might have the ability to achieve some things that he didn't really imagine were possible before.
But let's say he also tells you that let's say he's in his 40s. He was planning on working another 20 years. And at this moment, he and his wife plan to keep working in the next at least 15, 20 years. And you know what? They live in a perfectly fine house. And at the moment, they have no plans to move.
So the reason I would want to ask him what are his goals, like if he's got work that he thinks is meaningful and he wants to continue doing it, then what to do with that money consists, first of all, getting some good financial advice. But then making sure that you realize that it's a means, not an end. And one of the things that happens with people who are always struggling to make ends meet is it's pretty easy to start thinking of money as the goal, because you're always struggling just to get enough to get by. With all of a sudden having $50 million dropped in his lap, he doesn't need the money just to get by, but it can quickly take over his life. And if his goal isn't to be a money manager, you know, for the rest of his life, he has to get somebody else to do that for him.
One of the things he does ask you specifically, though, is he has a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old. They're happy kids, as far as you know and he knows. Do you tell the kids?
No. I would not, and there'd be an age at which you would. You know, you might tell them something because you might decide we're going to take a much nicer vacation.
Yeah.
Or we're gonna buy a new car,
mm-hmm.
right? So, and I think a few kind of modest improvements in lifestyle would be perfectly warranted. But you also got to pay attention. And I would point him to a number of studies that have been done on people who've won these very large jackpots and how it's made their life worse, right? And so, first of all, learn from that. And then, like, what happens to children who are given an extraordinary amount of wealth without any responsibility attached? I mean, like, it's not necessarily good for them.
Well, where I got this idea from for today's question, and no, I did not win $50 million. So that means we'll continue this podcast for a little longer. Because if we won $50 million, I don't know that I'd continue the podcast, Rick. We'll talk about that if it happens.
That you probably wouldn't tell me, so I would never know if this is true.
Well, no, but that gets to my point. So a couple things. One, the idea for the question, and I have sort of mixed feelings about him as a person and as a financial personality, I guess. But for whatever reason, a reel showed up on my Facebook feed of Dave Ramsey, and he got a call from somebody asking just this question. And in this case, Dave gave some of the same advice that you did, but the line that really stuck with me from the conversation, and it was what you were just getting at, was the caller who won all this money says, you know, I'm not going to, at least right now, I don't plan to tell my kids because I don't want them to grow up to be waiters. And Dave's like, waiters? He's, yeah, waiting for me to die. And he's like, I want them to, like, go out and find, you know, what their life is important, what's important to them, and not just be focused on this money. The thing, though, that occurs to me is, yeah, can you say, and maybe a little white lie, but like, oh, I got a little raise at work, so we can go to Disney World this year. Or, you know, your mom's car is like 10 years old and we're going to buy, you know, we're not going to buy a Maserati, but we're going to get something that's, you know, a little more reliable. Things like that you can probably do without anybody asking questions. But you're also saying anybody can and has blown through $60 million, you know, weirdly sort of quickly if you're like ridiculously irresponsible maybe. But like, there's no way you can either blow through that much money irresponsibly or be like incredibly philanthropic with that money without other people knowing, right? I mean, unless you're just doing like a huge series of anonymous donations, which I guess maybe you could do. And in the question, the way I framed it was, he's worried and tells you he's worried he doesn't always want people to be hounding him for money. And I understand that you might have some fourth grade pal of yours who you haven't talked to since you were both 9 years old, calling you up out of the blue and giving you a sob story about some medical bills. I mean, that may not be what you want, right? But at the same time, if there are people who you really care about and who are in your life and who you do want to help, at some point you can only get so many raises, right? At some point you have to kind of say, you know, I'd be happy to help you because here's why. So, I mean, is keeping the secret that important if that prohibits you from doing the beneficial things you want to do for your community or those around you?
There are certainly ways to benefit the community without broadcasting this. And so what I would do in this case is I would, in addition to consulting with a financial advisor, just like how do we invest it responsibly and fairly safely and so forth, and then put in kind of investment where I can draw a certain amount out.
Yeah.
I can draw a certain amount out and I can use this to help some people, but I'm not going to be drawing out of the principal in order to make investments in my brother-in-law's, you know, harebrained idea for a new business or something like that. But I would also go to my local community foundation
mm-hmm.
and set up a donor advised fund so that there's a fund set aside for some purposes that I think are really important in the community where I could have some input into that, but it wouldn't necessarily have my name attached. It would come out of this fund, right? If I wanted my name attached, it could be, but it wouldn't have to. And so then I could either be anonymous or I could take credit however I wanted to do it.
But I suppose, too, if you did that, and that's certainly good advice, and you wanted to, I want to take credit maybe is the way I would frame it, but at least not do it anonymously, that when people do come, like your fourth grade pal comes and calls, well, you can say, well, I'll tell you what. I have this fund at this foundation, and you're welcome to apply for a grant. And we get together a couple times a year and talk this over. But that's how I've decided to make my contributions in fair and equitable ways. I mean, in some ways, that's like a way to explain what you might do.
If you do something with a community foundation, that can only go to nonprofit organizations.
Yeah, that's true. Good point.
You can also have a family fund where you say, okay, yeah, we're gonna set so much money aside and we're gonna use it for anybody that we think needs some help and we're gonna make decisions on a regular basis. And I would set out some guidelines. And that also would be a good thing to introduce children to. Especially as they get older, and you'd have to see at what age, but at some point you make these decisions as a family and bring them into the decision-making process.
So I am pretty certain, I know the answer to this question, but you, Rick Kite, would never find yourself in this person's situation, correct?
I've never bought a lottery ticket.
That's what I thought. And I
don't think I ever will.
So you're not going to be, I'm not going to be advising you of how to spend down that or what to do if you win that $50 million windfall.
I think lotteries are state-sponsored scams.
I know that you have real
moral objections to them.
There's a lot of me that agrees with you. I probably, during an average year, I might drop $40 on the lottery. Like, you know, there's always the time, and I don't think we're in one of these moments now, but where you have those news stories. This is the fourth highest Powerball jackpot ever, and it's up to, you know, well north of 50 million. It can be 500 million or 700 million, right? So those are the times where I'll go, and if I happen to be at the gas station, I'll go in and give them a $10 bill, and they'll print off the receipt. And guess how many times I've won the jackpot, Rick? That would be zero.
That's what you're telling me.
So, yeah. So there are, obviously it's unlikely for me or anyone to be in this situation. However, I guess I can't ask you what you would do with a $60 million windfall, but there's really not a way that would ever happen. If it happened to me, you know, and I happened to one of those very rare times where I bought a ticket, I do think people would know. I mean, I don't think I would be, I would hope sincerely I would not be reckless. I mean, my boss is a fairly regular listener to the show, but I mean, I think I would probably, I'd give 2 weeks, but I think I would probably step away. I just feel like it's a big world. There's lots of places to go and see. And I'm afraid that if I was still working, I would just be distracted because I'd be like, you know, I've always wanted to go. This is true. I've always wanted to go to Malta, which is a small little island off Sicily, actually, the Mediterranean. And I'd be thinking about, like, you know, how can I spend 3 weeks in Malta and still have this job? Well, at some point, the answer is you probably can't. So I think I would, it would change my life pretty dramatically, I think.
The thing is, so it's hard for you to imagine from where you sit right now, it's hard for you to imagine what the real effects will be on your well-being if you were able to go and pursue anything you wanted to do.
Yeah.
And
I have a hard time believing there's too many downsides to that. But you're telling me I might be surprised?
Yeah.
Really?
The evidence, yeah. All kinds of people are surprised.
But I mean,
they go off and do anything they want. So they retire, somebody who just invested really wisely or made a success in business, and they've always wanted to travel, and they sell their house and they buy a big motor home, for example, and they go off and travel, and then they find themselves without community and not any, you know, their friends are, they're sharing posts on social media about all the great places they're going, but then they're drinking their coffee alone in the morning, watching the beautiful sunset.
See, what you don't understand, though, Rick, is I would have a community near my home in the south of France. I'd have a community near my home along the coast in Portugal. I'd have all sorts of communities.
Well, you'd have a whole bunch of people protesting these invading tourists, throwing eggs at your window.
Well, how about I'll leave it here that if I ever, you know, I think one. For Christmas a year or two ago, a family member gave me a scratch-off lottery ticket, and I won $100. So that was, I think, the most I've ever won. And this on a
did you spend it on more scratch-off tickets?
No, I cashed it out, and Travis and I went to right after Christmas when we spent that on our New Year's Eve dinner. That seemed like a perfectly fine thing to do. But if I ever do win some $50 million windfall. It will not be a podcast, but you and I can talk and you can give me all your careful warnings about how I should not let this ruin my life. Is that a deal?
I'll be sure to do that.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, I hear you have a question for me.
Lots of times in basic social interactions, you'll go into the workplace or you see somebody at the store and they'll say, "How you doing?" And the typical response is something kind of noncommittal, like, "Yeah, fine," or something like that. I had a friend who, like years ago, or an acquaintance, it was a work acquaintance, who always had a super positive response, like, "I'm doing great. I'm doing fantastic." And it was kind of annoying to me. And yet, over time, I thought, what he's doing is he's trying to be encouraging for other people, and he's creating a certain attitude. And I was thinking, should I do the same thing? Do I have a kind of responsibility to set a tone for people's day in how I respond to them? So I'm just wondering, like, do we have a responsibility to respond in a certain kind of way when people ask us these routine questions like, "How are you doing?"
How are you doing, Rick?
I'm doing great.
Okay. In this scenario, this is one of the rare times where we can learn a lot from politicians. And let me explain. I think you first have to determine whether this is just truly one of those, like you're passing in the hallway, "Hey, how are you, Rick? Good. How are you? Great." And you're just going to continue walking and there's not time or intention to have anything more than that. In that case, you know, I don't really care. I think it's sort of like filling space, like, "Hey, how are you? Great. Good. Good to see you." You know, whatever. And then that's just like a pleasantry. And I'm not sure I have a strong opinion about that. But if you're approaching someone where this may be anywhere from like a 2 to 12 minute discussion, and usually 2 or 3 or 4 minute discussions, and somebody asks, "Hey, how are you?" Here's why you should think like a politician. Especially when it comes to debates and other, annoying journalists like me ask politicians questions, skilled politicians will try to take that question and turn it into something they want to talk about. And I think that's exactly what we should do in these situations. If somebody asks you a boring question like, "Hey, Rick, how you doing today?" That is an opportunity for you to say, "I'll pick on something here in Wisconsin today," and this could change by the time the show comes out, but you could say, "I am doing great because right now the Milwaukee Brewers are having a fantastic year, and I am just so excited that the Brewers have the best record in baseball and look like they could go on to win the World Series. I've been a Brewers fan all my life, and I've never been as optimistic about them as I am right now." That takes a kind of a boring how are you doing, into like, hey, what are your thoughts about the Milwaukee Brewers right now? Or if you want to talk about how, like, just over a year ago, for example, we, during a thunderstorm, had a big tree next to our home fall into our house and had a large branch puncture our roof. And you would say to me, how you doing? I'm like, oh, it's been a busy day. Why is that? Well, I've spent all morning long dealing with roofing contractors to fix this hole, and just sort of take a minute to talk about that. So I think if that is a way to strike up a conversation, but it, you can take that as the most open-ended question in the world and be ready to talk about something you want to talk about.
Is that what you actually do?
I think I try to.
I think you do too.
And I don't, and I mean, maybe does that make me sound self-centered or something? I don't know, but I'm like, it, to me, it's like more interesting than, oh, you know, same old, you know, works fine, and then I'll go home. I mean, nobody wants to hear that. So like, find something interesting and talk about it.
So I love that response. And you, what you aren't, you aren't saying, you're not trying to just express a mood.
Yeah.
Which I think most people are doing.
Yeah, I mean, and sure.
Of some sort.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're trying to lead it into more conversation.
Yeah. And again, you have to make the assumption, you have to make a quick snap judgment that, yes, you have time for this. And like, there are people who I would never have a conversation about the Milwaukee Brewers with because they probably barely know who the Milwaukee Brewers are. So you have to kind of know your audience, right? But I think there are times where that's like a perfectly good way to like start a quick discussion about something and kind of blow past the, oh, I'm fine. How are you? Oh, good. How's your wife? Great. You know, I mean, nobody, I mean, unless you have like, oh, she was, you know, run over by a truck last night. Well, that's really a bad thing. But like, usually it's like, she's fine. You know what I mean? Whatever. So I think directing that discussion makes for better discussions.
By the way, are the Brewers doing well right now?
Yes, I'm sure you know this.
No,
I don't follow baseball.
I follow the Twins.
Well, I am
somewhat, and the Twins have been tanking recently.
So, okay.
So I've kind of quit following baseball altogether.
So we are recording this, full disclosure, on the morning of August 12th. So I can only speak to what's happening right now. But they have, like, they are like, by 5 or 6 games, have the best record above among every team in baseball. They have the best record at any point this deep into the season in the team history. They are playing in the smallest market in Major League Baseball in Milwaukee. And they are, there are a couple of like mediumly well-known players, but it is apparently a very easy team to fall in love with. They have a manager who has captured the imagination of the city. And even though it is a relatively small market, Milwaukee continues to either sell out or come close to selling out most of their games in their stadium. I am like you. I'm a Minnesota Twins fan. I don't hate the Brewers. I think the Brewers are a great team. I think they're a great organization. They also have a very low payroll. So, yes, they are having an extraordinarily great season at this moment.
I'm glad I asked you how you were doing because I had no idea.
Well, and of course I made it up. I mean, I'm actually a Twins fan and things there are not going quite as brightly. But yeah. So
it's still like great that the Brewers with a really small payroll,
yes,
are beating the pants off the Dodgers.
Yes.
Like
and the Yankees and all these teams with hundreds of millions of dollars of payroll. And I don't know off the top of my head what the Brewers' payroll is, but it is a fraction of some of those bigger teams. And, you know, there's all sorts of people smarter than me who can come up with the reason why they're doing so well. But they are undeniably one of the big storylines so far in the season across the game.
Oh, that's good to know.
But see, and I'm surprised you didn't know that. But nonetheless, at least like that's a conversation, you know, that was a bit contrived with your question, but like gets to something that's like that you walk away learning something about. And, you know, you didn't learn anything especially interesting about me. I'm not really a Brewers fan, although I think it's great they're doing well. But like, I think that is so much. So I guess, again, just to kind of go back to your initial point, treat these as open-ended questions and talk about whatever you want to talk about. Because and we always joke about, you know, in debates where somebody will say, oh, tell me about your immigration plan there, Senator. And like, well, they'll talk about the greatness of America and how, well, again, didn't really answer the question, but they're talking about what they want to talk about, and I think we should talk about what we want to talk about.
Thanks, Scott.
Anything else you want to talk about?
No.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma, and Rick, here is my question for you, and you'll probably guess by how this question is structured that this is exactly what happened to me just a couple of weeks ago, and I'll be curious to see what you would do in a similar circumstance. You and your wife spend 4 nights out of town at an Airbnb. The place is just as advertised, but you're surprised to see that there are baskets of snacks, a fridge filled with chilled drinks, and even some food in the cupboards. You had planned to go to the supermarket in that city to pick up some of these things, but now that they're already in the condo, do you simply enjoy those offerings instead?
It would depend a lot on whether I like them.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah, clearly if I don't,
but,
you know,
well, I know.
If it's a bunch of stuff you don't, but we'll assume that.
Yeah, let's assume it's stuff.
At least some of the stuff.
And some of the stuff is things I was planning to buy anyway. And yeah. Now here they are.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You would.
I would use them. And I would think this is one of the things I'm paying for.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, something like this happened to me. It was a couple of years ago, but I'd gone to I was on a trip and I'd rented this Airbnb that I was staying at for, I think it was 5 or 6 nights. And I'd stopped at a grocery store on the way there and picked up some groceries. And it was in a very small town that groceries are really expensive. And I had to buy things like butter, even though I'd used a little bit. I wanted some butter, you know, so I had to buy more than I need because you can't buy small enough amounts. And I get there and it had most of those things there, probably from previous people who had gone and stocked it up.
And just left behind sticks of butter.
Yeah. And I felt bad for one thing. I'd wasted a bunch of money, but also it's wasteful,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you don't use those things, I assume they're either there because the host put them there for your use, and that's part of what you're paying for. Or they were left by previous guests who had too much and had bought things and stocked it, one or the other.
In this case, it was a terrific Airbnb. The location was great, and this was sort of a surprise bonus. But you could tell by how these like baskets were set up. There were like three of them. And it was like, and they were, everything was very lined up. I think it was, I discovered that I had forgotten how much I like Nutter Butters, if you remember those.
Yes, I do.
But though there was like three of those next to three, and these were like, you know, six in a package, right?
But these are highly arranged.
Yeah, and like they're right next to the three Oreos, next to the three Chips Ahoy. And so it was not just, I think in the cupboard, I think there was like a half open bottle of olive oil that may or may not have, that I'm sure obviously stays there kind of like a long time until it's empty and who knows. But I would say from the just by the way things were set up, this was like 95% of things she provided. And I would imagine that whether it's online or at like one of those warehouse shopping clubs, that you can probably go in and whether it's Nutter Butters or other things, buy like a large box of 3 dozen of these and, you know, and when she or someone she pays refreshes the space, they're cleaning the bathroom, they're putting on clean sheets, and then they're also restocking the baskets. And I think what you're saying is that just like you're paying for clean sheets when you show up at this place, this sort of stitched into that price is all these other things. So I would tend to agree with you. I mean, I think we would agree, firstly, that it's probably if I like Nutter Butters and there's a couple of those, have at it. But if there were like a 3 dozen of those Nutter Butter packages, enjoying two while I'm there and taking 15 and sticking it in my bag so I can enjoy it at home is not really what it's supposed to be for, right?
Yeah, I think it's for your convenience and it's to make the stay a little more pleasant, right?
And I'll tell you, she had lots of positive reviews, maybe partially because of that.
But I assume you're also paying quite a bit for the place, and if you take the whole basket with you, It's not really cutting into the profits very much. Otherwise, they might do it less. There's kind of a general rule for any kind of behavior like this. Treat your host the same way you would want to be treated if you were the host. And so if you were doing something like that and you were putting things out for your guests, you might put out more than you think they need, so that they would have a selection of different things.
Because not everybody likes nut butters.
Right. But you're not putting it out so that they can stuff their duffel bag on their way out the door. That's not what you're doing it for. And if everybody was doing that, you would quickly probably start putting out less.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's not what you want either. Yeah, I mean, you're kind of appreciative.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So enjoy it in moderation, I would say.
And it was... Miss Travis and I had a little bit of a disagreement over it. I think I was more on your side. Again, I never for a minute thought we should pour every basket into our luggage and take it home. But like I assume that's the case. I mean, maybe it was things other guests left behind, but in the fridge was like probably 12 cans of assorted pop. There were some bottled waters, some with flavors. I mean, there was no alcoholic beverages, which is certainly understandable. But like we did have to go. We actually had friends over to this place and we made homemade pizza. And obviously there was not, you know, all the ingredients for homemade pizza. That would be kind of weird. But so we did go out and have to get like, you know, pizza crust and pizza sauce and pepperoni and all those things that start with P. And but like, the discussion kind of came around to the fact of, well, we did buy, I think, like a 6-pack of beer, but like, what if people don't want beer? Well, I said, well, we have like these 12 cans of assorted pop in the fridge. That seems like enough. And he kind of felt guilty about like using some of that. I'm like, well, I mean, that's what it's there for.
Yeah.
And I think we did not buy anything. And I think we probably... That night, there were two fewer cans in the fridge than the start of the night. So, I mean, it was not a big deal. So, I tend to agree with you that this is just sort of part of what you're paying for. And she has made the decision, I assume, that these perks either keep people coming back or keep her 5-star ranking pretty high up, which it was. And it's a business, I mean, she's not running this just to be a nice person, although she probably is a nice person. She's doing this to make some money, and that's great. But if at some point she comes to the conclusion that she's losing money on this, either A, she stops doing it, or B, raises the price on the whole unit. So I guess that gets to maybe two last questions. One, so let's say you're staying at this place for 4 nights like we did. And you see all this stuff that she puts out. But, you know, like I said, this is a lot of it's like, you know, I keep saying nut butters, but a lot of it was like that. These little packaged little snacks and pop in the fridge. And obviously none of this is like fresh fruits and vegetables. I mean, we understand why that is. And let's just say that like none of these things are things you have any appeal to you at all. And let's say you're either going to go out to eat or bring in fresh foods to cook in the kitchen of this place. Does part of you think, gosh, I'm kind of overpaying because part of this is for people who just sort of like this garbage processed food. And I don't really feel like I should be paying for that. Is that something that would even enter your mind?
That's interesting. It probably wouldn't. I mean, because this is so normal. The garbage food, that like the highly processed snack foods, are so common. They're everywhere. And you can't hardly avoid them. I would just assume, yeah, that's the host is putting out what's typical, what a lot of people appreciate, and what's also fairly inexpensive and easy to put out. I mean, but it's just not something that I'm going to enjoy. I'm going to go to the grocery store and buy some fresh fruit or something to snack on.
In talking to some friends about this afterward, two of them were like legitimately warning me, saying, "Oh, because they've stayed in hotels, that I think fewer hotels have this all the time, but it used to be a little more common in hotels. You'd have the mini bar, right? So you'd have these little bottles of bourbon and whiskey and stuff. And like they were, and maybe even some you know, snacks like
and
I
you
described.
Get charged $15 for one of the drinks out of any bar, or like $5-6 for a bottle of water.
Yeah. So a few of my friends were like, "Are you sure that this isn't something when you check out, there's going to be like you know a $60 addition to your bill?" And I'm like, "No. I mean, I think she would have disclosed that. It would have been, I mean, it would have been in the reviews certainly, right? That I just had you know four cookies and." Surprise on the bill. So, I mean, I wasn't worried about that, but it is correct that some hotels do still do that. And some hotels, although this also is less common, but some hotels still put out those little bottles of shampoo and conditioner and lotion that you used to be more common. My experience, at least, is that a lot of those, especially chain hotels and even some of the nicer hotels, have converted those into these larger pumps on the wall, I think, for a couple of reasons. One, it's just easier to refill, probably cheaper to buy that product in bulk, and better for the environment that you're not creating these tiny little bottles that one person opens to wash their hair, and then you just throw the thing away because you can't reuse that.
Yeah, it's much harder to take those great big bottles of shampoo home with
that are stapled to the wall. Yeah,
yeah.
But like, I guess in the days where that was more common in hotels, did you ever, and again, hotels seem a little different because like if it's the Marriott, that's like a multinational corporation versus Betsy, who we stayed with.
Would I take those little bottles?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because they're not leaving a half-filled bottle out for somebody else.
But let's say it's a bottle you don't open.
Yeah, maybe or maybe not. It depends on if... like the bottles of little bottles of lotion, I still appreciate that. They're really convenient for little travel lotion. So yeah, if there's a travel bottle of lotion out there, I'll generally take that because I'm going to use it in the next few days.
But like never a towel or
nothing like that. I mean those.
Yeah.
I mean, and I just assume it's expected that the reason they're tiny little bottles is because most people take them. It's what they expect, and so it's part of the package. The towels are not. That's hotel property, and they expect that to stay. I will give you an example. This summer, when my wife and I were driving back to Wisconsin from Colorado, we like to take different routes at different times. We kind of took an angled route up through Nebraska into South Dakota and then across. We had stayed at an Airbnb that was an old farmhouse, right, kind of on the Nebraska-South Dakota border, and it was way out in the country, and it wasn't like a 5-star type of property, it's just an old farmhouse, and we get in there, and there's this an old kitchen with a stove and refrigerator, and it's got a few things in the refrigerator like ketchup and mustard, so some of those condiments, And then in the cupboards, there's which we really appreciated. There's like a half open or half used package of coffee, some coffee filters, and there's a coffee pot on the counter. There's also some cooking oil and some popcorn. And these had all been open. They're just partly used. But we really appreciated having, like being able to make popcorn that night.
Yeah.
Right. But we never thought, oh, we've got half a bottle of cooking oil that we can just take home. Yeah. Here's, like a quart-sized jar of popcorn we can take home. We're thinking this is probably left there by guests. Maybe it was put out by the host for the guests to use, but it's put there to use appropriately, even though they were already opened. It's not... we didn't think there was any danger in using it. And
popcorn kernels are pretty uncontaminated.
Yeah.
Tough to contaminate.
But it's also there for us to use, but not to take. And a good rule of thumb is what is the intention of the host in this case? And use your judgment on that. And I think you can't go wrong.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to check out Rick's column about truth and ethics. And that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I'm Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.